On The Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is The Murder Squad. Las Cruces, New Mexico had only two murders in 1989. By February 10th, 1990, they would already have doubled that number in a single morning. Early on a Saturday, the staff of a bowling alley was prepping for their youth league to come in. But before the balls had a chance to roll down the lanes, two men entered with a completely different agenda.
The men, both armed, ended up with seven hostages in the office of the bowling alley. They took at least $5,000 from the safe, then shot each of the hostages at least once in the head. Before leaving, papers on the desk were lit on fire. One victim, a 12-year-old girl, was able to call 911. But even with the quick response, authorities are mainly left with rumors to investigate. Some about a hit, others about a drug deal, and others about an inside job. Others about a simple robbery, but none of the rumors have led to the two gunmen. Our job? To identify the two gunmen of the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre.
This is The Murder Squad.
Well, Billy, we spent a couple hours talking to each other a little bit earlier.
But we did. I interviewed Paul. Me and Alexis for our show Unraveled interviewed Paul, and that was fun.
It was a grilling.
I'm sorry. Yes, it was shorter than most of your interviews, I will say. I know what it's like to be in that chair. So, you know, we do have an update. Somebody sent us a really great tip for the Kansas College rapist. So we sent it over to Riley County. They followed up for more information. So hopefully we'll have more soon.
Fingers crossed.
Thank you for those tips that are coming in. And we're getting to all of them. So everybody that's sending in tips, thank you so much.
Yeah.
But for now, we're going to go to Las Cruces, New Mexico. In the early 1980s, Stephanie Cenac moved from Kansas to Las Cruces, New Mexico to manage her father Ron's bowling alley. She brought her daughter Melissa with her. In February of 1990, Melissa was in sixth grade at Lynn Middle School. Stephanie had been dating a guy named Lee Hauser. He also had a daughter at Lynn Middle School named Amy. The two girls helped Stephanie out at the bowling alley often. Now, the Las Cruces bowling alley had a restaurant and a bar. Let me tell you, there's nothing like a bowling alley bar. Some of my favorite bars out there are bowling alley bars.
I've never been to one.
Oh, Paul, you're missing out. I'll take you one. So it had a restaurant and a bar, also had, you know, video games, pinball machines, all that kind of thing. And it had a daycare. And Amy and Melissa would work in the daycare area that the bowling alley offered during league bowling. It was the job that 12-year-old Melissa and 13-year-old Amy were planning to do on the morning of February 10th. Stephanie and the two girls arrived at the bowling alley, which was on 1201 East Amador Avenue, at 8 a.m. to prepare the bowling alley to open. So Stephanie goes into the office. She's checking the receipts from the night before, and the girls go to the vending machines for snacks so they have something to eat while they're prepping for daycare.
The cook, 30-year-old Ida Hogan, had also arrived to prep the kitchen before the bowling alley was set to open at 9 a.m. Ida had worked at the bowling alley for 6 years. She had four children at home. She wasn't originally supposed to work the morning of the 10th, but changed her schedule to be able to go to a bingo game later. Stephanie's brother Steve dropped by to pick up his backpack, which he had left behind the night before. When he arrived at the bowling alley, the door was open. He noticed two Hispanic-looking men walking from the back to the front of the area. One was older. He saw the older man hand the younger man some sort of case. When Steve was leaving, he told his sister she needed to lock the door until the alley was open. Then he left. The women and girls continued to ready the lanes for their youth league that would be starting at 9 a.m. The league held over 40 kids, ranging in age from 4 to 12 years old. Sometime between his exit and 8:20 a.m., two men entered the bowling alley. Their faces were not covered, nor did they appear threatening at first. Melissa and Amy saw them as the girls were getting snacks at the vending machine. They asked the men if they needed help. Instead of making a request of the young girls, they each pulled a gun.
The men directed Melissa and Amy into the office where Stephanie was still going through the receipts. Once the three were in the office, the first gunman stayed with them, and the second gunman went to go to the kitchen to get Ida, and he brought her to the office as well. So after he got the final person from the building into the office, he went for the safe. The second gunman removed $5,000 from the safe, but that wasn't all the cash. It's unclear exactly how much was left behind. According to Ida, the gunman didn't just go into the cash. They were also going through cabinets as if they were looking for something else. Initially, she thought they were just going to rob them all and leave, but that was not the gunman's plan. While they were still searching the office, a guy named Stephen Turan had arrived. Now, Stephen was a mechanic for the Lanes, and he was graduating with a BS in criminal justice from New Mexico State University, and he had put in his 2 weeks' notice. He had only three more days to work at the bowling alley. On the morning of the 10th, his wife Audrey was working, so he actually brought along their daughter, 2-year-old Valerie, and his stepdaughter, 6-year-old Paula, to spend time in the daycare center. Stephen headed for the office to check in before starting the items on his to-do list. So Stephen walks in while this is all going on. They grab Stephen. They grab the two young girls into the office. So now the office has Stephanie, Ida, Melissa, Amy, Stephen, and the two girls. The gunmen tell everyone to kneel with their heads on the floor, and then they shoot all 7 of their hostages in the head. Before leaving the offices, they set fire to all the paper that had been left on top of the desk. So, Paul, on face value, what does this sound like to you? Because we're gonna get into the crime scene in a second, but straight robbery, shooting everyone, even a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, what is going on here?
Well, I think that the time that the gunmen arrive is interesting. The bowling alley is set to open at 9 a.m., and they're arriving within the hour of when the bowling alley is going to open. So I think that's very significant. They do go to the safe. They take at least $5,000 in cash. Now, the going into additional cabinetry, of course, is interesting, but that all could fall under a robbery. And it's possible that they're just ransacking, like sometimes, you know, burglars will do, looking for any other types of items of value that they could possibly take. Or maybe they had information that there was additional items of value or items that they specifically had interest in that they were trying to find. But yes, this appears on face value that this was a robbery, and then they eliminated the witnesses because they weren't expecting all these people inside the bowling alley at that time. At 8:30 a.m., Melissa was able to make her way to a phone in the bowling alley. She called 911. The dispatcher answered the phone to a crying and hysterical 12-year-old. Melissa told the dispatcher, "They told us all to get down. They shot me 5 times. The operator asked her to count the victims. Melissa responded with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Melissa asked them to hurry, adding, "It hurts." The dispatcher continued to talk with Melissa. She asked her if she could describe the men. She told her they were 2 black males, and she didn't know if they were still inside the bowling alley. Then she added there was a fire. Melissa also told the dispatcher she was shot in the head. She again asked them to hurry. When first responders arrived on scene, Melissa directed them to the office. The first responders removed all the victims from the office.
Yeah, and if you listen to the 911 call, the poise and the bravery of this 12-year-old girl to direct the police where to go, to direct the first responders where to go, while she has just gone through one of the most horrifying things you could ever think of, and she actually was shot in the head. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever listened to in terms of all of true crime.
We are actually going to play a part of the 911 call for you now. Listener discretion is advised.
Emergency.
Please help me.
Oh, well, slow down, slow down.
We were all shot and hold up.
Okay.
Las Cruces Bowl? Yes.
Okay, and there were shots fired?
Yes. All of us were hurt.
Huh?
All of us were hurt. I think I'm the only one conscious.
All of you were hurt? Okay, we'll get an ambulance rolling.
Please.
Okay. What's your name?
Melissa Repass. Please hurry.
Okay, Melissa, we've got him dispatched. Did you see who did it?
No, sir. They told us all to get down. They shot me 5 times.
Okay. We'll get him rolling, Melissa. Just hang on. Take a deep breath. We've got patrol units in route. How many people are hurt?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
7 people are hurt?
Yes, I think. I
7 subjects hurt. Okay. Okay, Melissa.
It hurts.
It hurts. Okay. Melissa, I've got an ambulance and I've got the police officers en route. They'll be with you just shortly.
Okay.
Okay. You didn't see what any of the
Mom,
men were
they
wearing?
They took all of our money.
You didn't see what any kind of the men were wearing or anything?
No.
Nothing, huh? They just walked in?
Uh-huh.
Do you know if they were black men, white men?
One black man. They're both black.
2 black men?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a fire, too.
There's a fire?
Right on the desk. They're going to burn us up.
Are the men still there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. They put us in the office.
They put you in the office?
Yes, I need a fire engine, too. Please help me.
And two. Okay, Melissa. She said they locked them in the office. She doesn't know if they're still there or not.
The door's open. There's a fire.
It's on Amador, yeah.
Please help.
Can you smell smoke, Melissa?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay.
Can I get the fire extinguisher?
Fire department, too?
Yes.
She says she smells smoke. They may have lit the building on fire.
No, it is on fire.
It is on fire.
It is.
Okay, Melissa.
Can I go get
by utility one?
Oh, ow.
Okay, Melissa, we've got him coming, hon. We've got him coming.
Is somebody there? He's calling my mommy.
Okay, Melissa, there's a police officer there now, okay?
There is?
Yes, there is. He's going to try and find you.
We're in the office. Just tell him.
Can I have 33 traffic?
Let me see.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Dying. Oh,
hold
dying.
On, Melissa. We've got the ambulance coming. They're just down the street. Huh? She advises all 7 are shot. They're injured. They're in the office. Where's the office at, Melissa?
In the door, in the front desk, and then you take a right, and we're right in the building.
Okay.
13-year-old Amy Hauser, 26-year-old Stephen Turan, 6-year-old Paula Holguin were all pronounced dead on arrival. 2-year-old Valerie Turan died 45 minutes later. She had been shot in the forehead. Melissa, who had managed to call 911, was taken to the hospital, and she was actually shot 5 times. She spent 11 days in the hospital. Ida had been shot 3 times. She was taken to the hospital as well, and her stay lasted 6 months, and she had to relearn how to do everything, walking, eating, everything. Stephanie suffered brain injuries from the massacre, and according to Melissa, she was never the same. And she actually died 9 years after the murders from complications due to her injuries. So we're talking about the murders of 5 people and severe injuries to 2 others. Firemen brought hoses in to put out the fire that was set in the office. And the efforts to save the victims and also put out the fire created a disaster for the scene to be processed. But the police did try to process the scene. They were able to collect fingerprints, but this was a bowling alley, so many people could have left their fingerprints behind. And, you know, we're talking about 1990, DNA technology is still new. I doubt in Las Cruces, New Mexico, they swabbed for DNA.
No, they didn't. Yeah. I guarantee it.
So we've got the crime scene photos. We're going to walk through them. Paul, I want you to tell me sort of what you see here. But the first thing we want to do is talk about the timing of this because, you know, Steve comes by at 8. The door is unlocked. There's sort of like this time period in between when everybody shows up and when it's open. Another really important thing is that this is on a Saturday morning. Friday night is league night. A lot of cash changing hands. They would know that there was going to be a lot of cash in the building that morning, and there would be the least amount of people there that would be able to, you know, give them any kind of fuss. This really did seem like somebody had some sort of inside information.
Yeah, that's a possibility for sure.
So what do you see? You know, we've got these crime scene photos, and what sticks out to you, if anything?
Well, you know, first the
the handful of scene photos, we have photos that show first responders and paramedics working on the victims. And that does give some insight as to the type of disruption that is occurring to the crime scene. You know, the crime scene is left by the offenders, and then you have first responders coming in and completely changing aspects of the crime scene. So their activity always has to be taken into account. You know, unfortunately, I don't know everything that they've done, so I can't talk about, okay, this is done by the first responder versus this is how the offender left the scene. But the things that really stand out to me is, let's talk about the fire. Though we mentioned that the offenders set fire to the paperwork on top of the desk, when I'm taking a look at the scene photo, as well as the crime scene video, which we have snippets of law enforcement's video, it's not all the paperwork that's on the desk. There were what appears to be a plastic, you know, inbox, outbox type of office apparatus, if you will, that had paper in it. And then another source of paper next to it that was primarily targeted with the fire. You see a lot of burnt paper that has been distributed throughout the office. Now, some of this is due to the fire itself. Just as you watch, you know, a wood being burned and you see the ashes floating up and floating down, that's what's happening here. But there's also appears to be a fire retardant that has been spread over the desk, which it looks like maybe a fire extinguisher had been used by responding personnel. And you imagine the forces, you know, of this gust of fire retardant that's also going to be blowing, you know, small pieces of burnt paper as well as larger pieces of partially burnt paper and distributing it throughout the office. And some of this paper is landing on top of existing blood patterns showing that sequence. So it's, you know, this blood pattern, the smear that's on the floor occurred before some of the paper that landed. And then there's other items that appear to be on top of the blood patterns. And this is where I'm starting to get a little bit interested, because it, at least with what we have, is that it was first responders that were pulling the victims out of the office, probably because of the fire. They need to get the victims away from where the fire is occurring. But now you have larger items that have been placed on top. And that's part of the sequencing information that I would want to verify to make sure that I'm seeing that correctly and that the offenders didn't leave some of these items, didn't touch some of these items. But the fact that the primary focus of the fire was on those two stacks of paper, if you will, and not throughout the scene. Mm-hmm. On one hand, you could see a very unsophisticated offender saying, well, that's a source of fuel right there. I'm going to just going to start it on fire and it's going to destroy all the evidence throughout the scene. Obviously, no accelerant was brought. No accelerant was used. Probably used a lighter or a match. And it was ineffective at destroying everything within this scene. It's a very limited fire, relatively speaking. But the other possibility, especially considering the weird searching that these offenders did in the cabinetry, what was the information contained in the paperwork that was targeted for the fire? Mm-hmm. And that would be something that I would want to know. Were they trying to destroy specific information? So I think both options are on the table at this point.
Paul, that's a really good point. I didn't even think of that. You know, and one of the things that shocks everybody about this is the manner in which this wasn't a robbery that went wrong. It wasn't somebody went for the gun and then somebody started shooting or anything like that. This was planned, and it was also not like one of the guys decided then we've got to shoot everybody, because there wasn't a point where the living witnesses said, one guy said, what the hell are you doing? We're not shooting everybody. You know, so these are two guys that went in with the idea of, we are going to rob this place, we are going to kill everybody in there, and then we're going to leave. Well, it's the thing that always struck me about this case is it reminds me of the case at the Clutter Farm from In Cold Blood, where two guys are in jail. They find out about a safe that's supposed to be in a house. They go and they rob it, and then they end up, you know, killing the people inside.
Mm-hmm.
We know a lot about that, whether it's, you know, we know Capote made up some things in there, but we know a lot more about that than this, because we don't know who these guys are. But it strikes me, the thing that I think about this is that they all agreed on this. They agreed on what they were going to do. They went in and they went out. I think these are guys that have done time before. They were in jail before, and we're not going back. There's no chance we're going back. So we need this money. We're not going to leave any possibility that somebody could recognize us. And the fact that they also walked in without masks.
Yes.
So they knew what they were doing. This was all planned. The fact that they didn't bring accelerant, when they did bring a .22 pistol and they did bring a briefcase, is interesting. Was that because it seems like they were very organized, your idea that they, maybe they were burning something specific is really interesting.
Well, and I also think, you know, one of the things that I don't know is, did they force an employee to open the safe for them? Was the safe already open, or did they open it themselves? At least in the video where it appears that there's some close up of what I think is the safe, and I'm not entirely confident of it, the safe does not look damaged. It does not look like it's been pried. So it tells me that it was opened through normal means. If they are going there specifically for cash, and let's take the theory that you have that they have done time before, now they're going in to get this money. Why are they choosing to do it at this particular time when there's people there? Why not middle of the night when nobody's there? You know, so that could be that they did not know how to get into the safe, and that they thought, well, they had information that an employee who knew how to get into the safe would be there, and they could just force that employee to open the safe for them to make their life easier. But the butting up against when everybody's going to be showing up for the youth league really is risky for them. So it's an interesting aspect to this case that I don't have a clear thought on, but I think it's significant to dig into. Why not middle of the night if they just wanted money?
Yeah.
So police end up setting up roadblocks by 10 a.m. that morning. A witness had claimed to see two men in a van or utility vehicle. The authorities screened every person who arrived at the roadblocks, at one point stopping a group of four men who caught their interest. The group of men had $12,000 in cash on them. They brought Stephanie's brother Steve down to attempt an identification. He didn't recognize any of the four men, but he was able to give a good enough description of the men he had seen earlier that morning to create a sketch.
Yeah. So, you know, taking a look at the sketch, the thing that everybody says about this, and even Captain from True Crime Garage said the same thing. The first sketch of the younger man looks like Eddie Murphy. Okay. Bottom line is, it just looks like Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
And if you were to show that to anybody, you know, we're talking about, you know, a little bit later than Beverly Hills Cop, I believe the Captain said Coming to America era Eddie Murphy. The second sketch of the older gentleman, he has a receding hairline. His face is a little bit more thinner and weathered. But, you know, Steve apparently had a good look at these guys as he was, you know, retrieving his backpack from the previous night before.
I wanted to talk because we very rarely have a case that has roadblocks in it. And they tried for basically 12 hours of roadblocks around the entire area. How useful are roadblocks? Is it a technique that should be used? And how quickly does it need to be used to be effective?
Oh, well, you know, roadblocks generally, I mean, law enforcement employees they have a method in which when they have a crime like this occur via the radio, they can dispatch patrol units as well as highway patrol to select locations. So now you have law enforcement that is monitoring primary arterial routes that would the offenders likely would use on their escape, whether it be a main road leading away from the bowling alley or the freeway system, etc. Actual roadblocks, at least in my jurisdiction, I can't think of a time when they did that, where they were stopping and talking to everybody. But I know that that has been done in select instances. To be frank, I don't recall a time where there is a major homicide case in which the suspect was actually caught fleeing as a result of this pre-positioning of the vehicles. But it is something that does happen. Law enforcement does employ it, and it's possible that they could catch somebody in this net. Just how frequently is it successful? I don't think it's very successful, to be frank.
Yeah, you know, they weren't necessarily doing roadblocks, but they were watching the bridges and tunnels during the Son of Sam case.
Yeah.
And Berkowitz knew that. What Berkowitz would do is he would commit the murder, which was usually late at night, and then he would just buy a paper and read it in the park, wait until all the cars had gone in, and then go back midday when they weren't looking anymore.
Yeah.
So
They're most certainly the offenders are aware that law enforcement is looking for them, especially in this case. Well, you know, these guys may not have known that 911 was called right away. You know, they go through and shoot each of the hostages in the head. And I know there's a question about how effective, you know, this killing method was. Well, it's about as effective as a killing method there is in terms of you shoot people multiple times in heads. Usually you're successful. In this particular case, you know, they had multiple victims survive.
Yeah. So robbery seemed like the easy answer for this crime. Stephanie's father, who is also the owner of the bowling alley, Ron, said it had been robbed several times over the years. Plus, almost a month earlier, Ray's shell service station was robbed on January 14th. 32-year-old Salvador Lozano was killed just after 8 a.m. when he opened that store. So, you know, 2 hours after the store opened, customers discovered Lozano's body. He'd been bound and he'd been shot in the back of the head, and the killer had only gotten $500 from the store. So look similar.
Yeah.
Very similar, especially in a town that did not have many murders. But ultimately, the two crimes became thought to be not related. And Detective Mark Myers from the Las Cruces Police Department said the murders were the result of a robbery by experienced criminals who wanted to leave no witnesses, obviously. He said he believed this wasn't their first crime. But if it was just a robbery, why did they leave any money behind? Authorities did have a steady stream of leads right after the murders. Remember, Las Cruces before the massacre was fairly safe. The year before, in 89, there were only two murders. However, before February 1990, there were two more before that bowling alley.
Some tips that came in were vague, like two men looking for the interstate or men running across Amador Avenue. Other community members reported there was a gang that lived just a few streets away from the bowling alley. Then a local woman made a report. She said that not only had she met the two gunmen, she let them stay with her. It was the best lead police had received. They went to interview the women. According to the 2011 documentary, A Nightmare in Las Cruces, she appeared high and they weren't sure how credible her statement was. She told them they hid at her house and heard the helicopters overhead searching. According to this woman, the killings were over drugs. She said they had a huge stash at the bowling alley. Even with shaky credibility, the police gave her a polygraph. She passed. However, once she was sober, she recanted her statement.
How do you deal with that, Paul? This witness sounds plausible. How do you investigate? She was high. She recants. What are you thinking?
Well, you know, first, there's if you can, you have multiple interviews of her to see how much of her statement stays consistent across the interviews. And that sometimes is done in the pre-poly before the polygrapher starts asking her the yes-no questions. Now, it's a theory that, you know, considering the activities of the offenders per the 12-year-old girl that, you know, survived, you know, there is something credible about the idea that they were looking for more than just the cash. They took the cash because they could, but maybe there was a lot more value in drugs that potentially was in the bowling alley that was taken that nobody else knew about except for maybe a select individual.
So police began to take a closer look at Stephanie's father, Ron, and Ron had told local media, "We're determined not to allow this insane act of two individuals to permanently alter the lifestyle of the community." He actually reopened the bowling alley 6 days after the massacre. According to one of the victim's brothers, Ron didn't have the best track record with money. And in fact, at the time of the murders, he was actually living inside the bowling alley. Ron admitted this was true, and he was also out of town the day of the killings. He had gone to Tucson, Arizona for a golf trip. He told different media two different stories. On one hand, he said he asked the police daily for updates, and when the Las Cruces Police Department heard this, they said it was absolutely false. Not only had he not asked for updates, they actually had to go searching for him. And when asked why he wasn't cooperative, his answer was he didn't like being considered a suspect. So by the end of 1990, Rod Sinek actually sold the bowling alley to a person in California. And at the time of the sale, the business was $1.5 million in debt. So, you know, we have this guy living in this bowling alley. It's his business. His family works there. The idea that this could have been some of the ideas that have been floated around are this was a planned robbery for insurance purposes. And then because these guys didn't hide their faces, they felt they had to kill the witnesses. They, you know, thinking of Ron potentially as a person of interest because he was a little shady, but this crime just goes so beyond the pale, for somebody to set something up like that.
Yeah. You know, I would lean more towards if Ron is involved, it's whatever was happening inside the bowling alley is what drew these two killers there. There was something that they wanted up and beyond just the $5,000 in cash. And they had information to suggest that there was something there. That's why they're searching. They're doing additional searching than just going beelining straight for the safe. While the Las Cruces Police Department were never able to find evidence that linked Ron, they did look into the possibility it could have been a hit. One of the victims, Ida, told Fox News the gunman seemed startled by the number of people they encountered, which at the very least, they had cased the bowling alley, or they had been given the lay of the land by someone. But Ron wasn't the only member of the Sinek family that could have had a potential hit linked to him. He had another child, RJ. Much like his brother and sister, he worked at the bowling alley. RJ tended the bar. According to family and friends, RJ had a drug problem, cocaine specifically, and the bar is where he usually had his drug deals. Rumors around town swirled that he may have been the intended target.
So now this gets more interesting, and not necessarily saying that RJ was the, you know, had it something to do with it. But you have a guy with a drug problem who's doing his drug deals there. Mm-hmm. He might be keeping his drugs there. But also, when you have a drug problem and you get into issues with people when it comes down to money, you might trade information for to give yourself a little bit more time to get the money. He might have told these two gunmen or told somebody else who told these two gunmen, "I don't have any cash on me. I know I owe you a lot of money, but listen, there's a bowling alley. My dad owns it. On Saturday morning, there's not going to be a lot of people there. You know, you can go in, they can open the safe for you, and you'll get at least $5,000.
Yeah, you know what I would want to know is, what is the pattern on a Saturday morning at that bowling alley? Is there just usually one or two adults inside the bowling alley, and it just happened that this Saturday, you know, these adults brought children with them? I'd be kind of curious, because that could lend itself to the idea that the gunman walked into something they were not expecting, and maybe they fully expected to have to kill a couple of people in order to get the money that maybe was owed them, or to, you know, get the drugs, the stash of drugs that they were sure were being kept inside this bowling alley. But it's doubtful that they walked into this bowling alley thinking, well, we're going to have seven people that we're going to have to shoot in the head. This is, again, not something that they would, you would see these types of individuals specifically choose. It just elevates their risk. Yeah. I think they would have avoided that and chosen a better time.
No, I think they did not. They certainly didn't think that the three kids were going to be there. Mm-hmm. Four kids actually were going to be there. I think that they thought that Ida would be there manning the kitchen, or somebody else would be, you know, prepping the kitchen, and that Stephanie would be in the office and she would be able to open the safe.
Right.
There would probably just be two women there. I think they believed that the mechanic, Steve, was going to show up later. I think they probably thought that they were going to be able to be in and out by the time, because they had a short window, you know, really of kind of like 30 minutes and they in between when 8 o'clock happened. And I think maybe the brother showing up might have stopped their timing and halted their timing a little bit, because they see him come in. They say, oh, no, wait, let's wait for him. And that might have put them off schedule.
Yep, I agree.
Authorities said RJ never gave them more information than was asked of him. And unfortunately, in 97, they couldn't ask him any more questions because he died of a probable overdose. Unlike with many of the cases we cover, the case has surviving victims. That allowed the police more info. Once the surviving victims were able to talk, new descriptions were given. Melissa's statement, member of black men on the 911 call, was corrected to two Hispanic gunmen. One was about 30 years old. He had dark wavy hair and light colored eyes, and he was about 5'10", 170 pounds. The victim said he didn't have an accent. The second man was older, somewhere around 45 to 50 years old. His salt and pepper hair was thinning. He had a dark complexion, was 5'7", 140 pounds. He had a slight Spanish accent. And remember, we're only probably 20 minutes or 30 minutes from the Mexico border.
But despite this and the hundreds of tips that came in, police were nowhere. They had asked the state police for help. Even with that support, they weren't able to locate the two men. They even tried unconventional means of investigation, hypnosis for the victims, and psychics claiming to have information. Neither of the efforts panned out. So they reached out to the media. In March of 1990, Unsolved Mysteries aired a segment on the case. New leads came in, but again, no answers. 5 years later, a piece aired on America's Most Wanted. It brought 60 new tips, but they again led to dead ends. Detectives made appearances on local and national media around the anniversary of the massacre for years, hoping to shake the right tip loose. In March 2020, they announced a $30,000 reward for any information that could lead to a suspect. Again, it brought in about 60 new tips, and again, none of them got the investigation any closer to be solved.
So that leads us to our weekly assignment. Steve Turan's brother has expressed frustration to the media, wondering why they haven't caught these men. And it's a frustration that we're hoping the murder squad can help with. We want to give you the description of those two suspects again. Now, remember, this is back in 1990. This is also, we know a lot of our listeners might be younger. This is a time to share this with people that don't listen to us. It was two Hispanic gunmen. One was about 30 years old. He had dark wavy hair, light colored eyes, 5'10", 170. Didn't have an accent. Second man was older, 45 to 50 years old. Salt and pepper hair was thinning. Dark complexion, 5'7", 140. He actually had a slight Spanish accent. These sketches have been seen far and wide, but we also want to talk about dates and times. Anyone who fits the description, who maybe might have gotten out of prison within the year prior. Anyone who might have left town in the early 1990s for a while, perhaps never to return. And one of the things I always want to remind people is don't always look at them as a pair. Look at them separately. Sometimes when you have two sketches, it can get in people's heads, well, I think I know what this guy looks like, but I've never seen him with this other guy, so they don't call it in. So think about that, them separately. These two men shot seven people. Stephanie Sinak, Melissa Rapace, and Ida Holgan all survived that morning's massacre. Although Stephanie eventually died due to her complications from her injuries 9 years later. The men killed Amy Hauser, Steve Turan, Paula Holgan, and Valerie Turan. All seven deserve justice. So if you have information, please contact us or you can send a tip into Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477, or you can text a tip at 274-637. And when you text, include LC tips, which is Las Cruces tips, and you can remain anonymous.
Yeah, you know, and I kind of want to add just another observation about the evidence in this case. Because this is such a disrupted crime scene, obviously, it's a hard scene from a physical evidence standpoint in order to find something that could identify the offenders. But when you think about this crime and these two gunmen having to control seven individuals, including three adults, I start to wonder, did they go hands-on, in particular with the adults, or with any of the victims? And do we have has the agency pursued DNA testing on the victim's clothing? That may be something that if they haven't done, I would suggest. And one of the things that stood out to me, which may be nothing, but the adult female that was laying on her back in the crime scene, both her shoes were untied. And I'm taking a look at that, and I'm wondering if one of the offenders was untying the shoes in order to get binding material with the thought of binding this woman up. And then Steven comes in with his kids, and now the plan has to change. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then those shoelaces could be key evidence.
Interesting. Okay. So we will have pictures of the sketches up on social media. And again, these are one of those things where you take pictures, you save them, and then you text them to your older friends, older relatives. You share it, especially if you're within the Texas area, South Texas, South New Mexico, just in those southern areas, you know, along the border. And, I think this case potentially could still be solvable. You know, we always think all of them could be. Don't you think, Paul, as far as the fingerprints, mm-hmm. since they were going through all of the file cabinets and stuff like that, you would think that they would have probably printed those first. Would they have just been too gummed up with so many other people's fingerprints that it would have been rough?
No, you know, anytime you're in a public location like this, you do that. You most certainly focus your efforts on areas that you know or like, highly suspect that the offenders touched. And most certainly the safe, any of the cabinetry, other surfaces like points of entry would be fingerprinted. And yes, you're going to get a bunch of fingerprints that are not related to the crime. But you have to do it. And I would say that those cabinets and that safe, if they have latent cards, those would be priority items. And if the agency has not addressed those recently, they should readdress them with the modern fingerprint technology that is being employed today.
Absolutely. So that takes us to the rules. Don't name names. No side-by-sides. You know, we've got sketches in this one. Don't dox each other. Just be nice. Now we go to the weekly distraction. Paul, I know you've got a distraction. We did pregame a little bit today. So what's been distracting you away from this life of crime solving?
Well, as I've mentioned before, you know, I was out of Los Angeles for almost 6 weeks and somewhat quarantined. And so I'm finally home. And it's not like freezing temperatures here in Colorado. So I've been able to several times get out on my bike, out on the trails. And it has been like a soul replenishing to be able to go do that after what I went through the last month and a half, to actually be out in nature and see the mountains and to get a good workout in at the same time. So that really has been my distraction. It's, I don't think about crime while I'm out there, and I'm just, enjoying the scenery. And it's been way too long. So that's been good. It's been good for my mental health, for sure.
That is fantastic.
And the squirrel made an appearance, right?
Oh,
Yeah.
Did you bury the lead there? Did the squirrel make an appearance?
Well, you know, the squirrel did sense that I was not around the house and was trying to, kind of break in. And Cora caught it. Cora was right there at the window when the squirrel was trying to make its move. And so I did post a photo of that. Cora is quite the watchdog when I'm not around. Now, when I'm home, she just lays down on the floor, and she just turned 8 years old. So she's getting up there for a larger yellow lab.
That's great. Well, my distraction is, having gotten the my second shot now, I volunteered five weeks ago or something like that. And I implore everybody to do it. If your vaccine stations have volunteer stations, for some reason, mine was 12 hours. I don't know why it was 12 hours in the Phoenix sun, but, I think a lot of other places it's 6 hours or 8 hours, but you felt like you were part of history, and it was really interesting how it was just the logistics of it all and how it was all happening. But now I'm getting ready to do the thing that I've been missing the most, which is getting ready to play hockey again.
Oh.
So it's been I think I've concentrated a little bit more on weightlifting during the quarantine and not so much on cardio, and I'm feeling it. So in this comeback, I've got to, I just got to up the cardio a little bit. So that's been my distraction of... another year older, a year of, when you're in the house, man, you just don't get the steps,
No, and, that's true.
So building up my cardio is my key for the next, 3 weeks before I'm going to go hit the rink again. So,
well, are you doing that via skating, or are you doing that some other
way? I skated for the first time in about, since I left for Long Island to do Unraveled, which was like August. So I skated for the first time in August. It was okay, but it was like, I'm going to need 3 more weeks in order to get up to speed. Yeah. It's not going to be good.
Yeah. Take it slow for sure.
Take it slow. I know. You're not a young man anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen to this old man.
I know. Well, if you've made it this far, thank you everyone for listening, and, follow us on social. Give us a review. That'd be nice. And until next time, keep digging.
Keep digging.
And don't be an irony.
Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.